You are listening to a production of the Toll Network, home of Biting Analysis. This is Uncommon Cast RX 143, Memory Lane.
I'm Ill, the thesis-seeking critic. Do I read?
I'm Amit, the heart-snacking critic. Do I think?
I am Sona, the even more mom critic. Do I green?
Putting yours on trial! Critical Squadron, Duat Ranger!
Join us as we take a critical eye to Kamen Rider Ghost. Will Takeru save himself and the Kamen Rider franchise in the 39 days he has left on this blue planet? Find out how we think he's doing as we pass judgment on Kamen Rider Ghost 32 Reminiscence, The Hidden Heart.
Our writer was once again Hasegawa Keiichi. Our director was Watanabe Katsuya. Our action director was Miyazaki Takeshi. Once again, I don't know how to feel about Hasegawa on this arc. This arc was kind of a monkey's paw wish for me. Where
that's a good way to put it, yeah.
We're like, oh, I get this whole arc about this minor character, except it's, like, really badly handling child abuse. So, you know, I've got some thoughts on Hasegawa that, you know, will come into things later, but kind of dropped the ball on this one, dude.
That's a fair-minded way to put it, yeah. Well, I mean, it wasn't like a total face plant overall entirely. It's
literally the same way this story always goes, which is not good. But you know, let's get into it because I think we all have some thoughts on that.
Okay, so, man, my focus. For so many reasons, I'm not entirely sure what to think about this episode of Ghost. Igarashi's past explanations were inevitable and fairly unsurprising, which, like, that's not how it's supposed to be. I enjoyed seeing the past with Sage and the others together. It was pretty cool. I even liked the glimpses into Miho and Shibuya's past, but it all felt kind of disconnected. There is no clear moral other than perhaps always forgive your parents because they're trying their best, I guess. While I feel it is laudable to be charitable and that forgiveness can have healing properties for the offended, it was not handled well here and almost felt like it was more in the service of something coming down the line for Takeru.
Yeah, overall, I'm really disappointed in how this arc handled Shibuya and his mom. The whole thing is lazy with how often this exact story has been told, and, you know, frankly, I think it's irresponsible. At its core, this whole manly issue is a giant problem and, you know, obviously is the root of this whole issue. But look, I understand that's a cultural thing that takes time, and that for a woman who appears to have walked out of Cromartie High and into Kamen Rider, I can sort of just, you know, sigh and let it go because that's a fight that I don't have the energy to have anymore. But she kicked her son. And look, emotional abuse is horrible. It can and it will irreparably screw people up. But, you know, the greater public and, you know, children's media, I guess, is not yet at a place of acknowledging and properly dealing with that, apparently, and it's too much of a headache for me to rail against it for too long, because if I do that, I end up sick, and I don't want to relive my experiences with doing it for 6 months while watching Gaim. But how did this entire arc go through all of the layers of the creative process with this woman physically kicking her son, making contact, and no one stopped to think, hey, maybe we shouldn't do that. Maybe that one thing there where she kicks him shouldn't happen. Like, and then Shibuya, like, runs into this fight with the Ganma and his mom, who at the time doesn't know who he is, calls him manly, and suddenly the whole problem is magically solved, and Shibuya forgives his mother, who, you know, physically and emotionally tormented him for not meeting some arbitrary standard, to the point that he ran away and hasn't gone home in 3 years. She's displaying this exact trait, picking on someone that's weaker than her and that can't defend themselves, that her quote-unquote prince said he hated people for. And I'm disappointed in Takeru. Look, I know he was coming off this high of his father believing so much in his 8-year-old self that he wanted to help him save the world, and he's viewing the situation through that lens. But no matter what he's seen in Shibuya or his mom's memories, he should acknowledge that his friend feels attacked and hurt instead of, oh, but every parent loves their kids, because I don't care if she does love him, she attacked him. So, you know, I barely even care what the overall message in this episode was, because even though I knew this was exactly how this episode was going to go.
And y'all y'all can check last week. That is, we have receipts for that.
Yeah. I put that one out on the table. I knew exactly that where this was going. I'm just so frustrated by how it was handled, and I wish there was some room for me to believe that Shibuya is still going to be keeping his distance from his mom after this. We're like, yeah, okay, they reconciled, but then he goes home and is like, no, I'll go with her to, you know, pay respects to dad in a year, but otherwise, no. But it seems like everything is fine, and now they're all good, and he's gonna go see her sometimes, or something. And again, it's just lazy and irresponsible.
Yeah, I think it's those last two words that are kind of the rock stars of this part of the discussion. Because, like, look, I can see where they're going. I can see what they're trying to say. They're trying to talk about, like, hey, you know, because there are kids who are going to, you know, whose parents do this kind of crap to them. And, like, I hate to bring us to that kind of place. I don't like going that kind of dark. This is not a thing I bring up to be frivolous. Yeah, anyway. So they're trying to put context in it and help the kids understand their world and stuff like that. And I think that's what they're trying to do. You know, they're a single parent. She's stressed. And if they come from a place where violence was the thing, that's why they do it. Not for nothing. A kid shouldn't have to worry about that. Period. End of. Like, cool people don't wreck other people's lives while screaming, stop being so selfish and think about what I need. And when they do, we don't consider it the job of the person whose life got wrecked to understand them and then further wreck themselves in pursuit of trying to help that first person who did the wrecking get better, which they only don't really seem to want to do. Like, again, I get what they're trying to say, like how you should forgive people and be kind and understand, but for real, the amount of stuff this show is okay with, this episode, maybe not even this show, but this sequence here is okay with parents laying on kids, like, it's unreal. And all I can think is, like, the many times I've had someone offer me a supposedly inspirational phrase, and because of how kind of messed up I am in the head, all I can hear was the absurdly negative corollary, and then I'd get mad depressed for a long time because everyone agreed with this supposedly inspirational phrase, and all I can think is, oh, well, the whole world agrees. I'm crap. Thanks! So, all I can think is, like, this chunk needed another thematic go-over. Like, what are we putting on these kids? Or what would a healthy coping and communication mechanism look like? Or, Shibuya, your mom didn't ask your permission before dragging you into her drama. It's nice that you want to fix it, but also that is not your job, so you can still love her and forgive her and whatever, and also stay way the hell away from her because she keeps hitting you and that's not okay. But yeah, it's just kind of really disappointing to see the team who have been so good overall really faceplant this bad on something that is kind of big and kind of important and maybe would be worthy of a much more serious going over. I'm sorry, like, our focus went, like, real hard, listener. We're not trying to bring anybody down. It's just, like,
well, yeah, here's the thing about focus. Focus is one of the key elements in utilizing a laser cutter. So, I mean, it's right there. Sometimes you just gotta burn through things with your focus, and that's what we've done here.
I like that.
I hate getting so negative about this show because I love it. and I love, like, 99% of the things it does, but this was not okay.
Yeah. And look, if nothing else, like, no one can say that we are mindlessly positive about Ghost.
This is true.
It does, but, like, you know, we're not, you know, we don't love it for no reason. It's just when stuff like this happens,
we like, will not accept. We will not accept anything that it does. Clearly,
yeah.
But...
Let us take the really brave stance and say, child abuse is bad. Yes, I am very smart and clever and moral. Yes, look at me. No, but seriously, child abuse is terrible. It's so beneath them, it's so thematically muddled, it really messes with the other thing they're trying to do, which, by juxtaposing Ryu talking about, like, yes, I believe in Tenkaru, in my son's infinite potential, with a mother just hitting her son, and her son just sucking up and taking it, like, that's not the thing you want to think, oh, so what Ryu's doing is exactly what she's doing, like, that's not the thing you want. But it's the statement that kind of gets made when you put these two statements together.
It is. With the resolution here, that's exactly what is said. Let's move from all the negativity into the bones now.
Into the other negativity!
Oh.
I already laid everything out on the table, so I've got nothing else for this.
Well, that's good. you need to just release and let it go for now. So, I just have small things. Everything kind of felt disconnected, and that made me unhappy.
Yeah.
I mean, thematically, the scenes, the way it flowed, everything was off, which was surprising. Let's see. So the kids continuing to de-age should have arced better. Like, you could have had some teens, and then preteens, and then children, but they didn't for some reason. And
that would require hiring more actors.
This is true. Or... instead of 12 kids, you could have done 4 kids and showed them in 3 stages. Anyway, but I know what you mean. Then, like, Miho, you know, Miss Shibuya's mom, like, she should have gotten younger too, but she didn't, and that messes up the flow of the idea for me. I'm sure there's some pedantic explanation for why she didn't also revert or whatever, the same as the others, but I don't want to hear it because it just looks dumb. It does.
No, look, I'm not arguing.
No, I agree. Like, that did feel weird.
And then, like, the use of the concept of men and manliness was so poorly addressed as to leave the viewer content to not examine their own estimation of manliness.
Yeah, and I think that was one of my big problems, too, because, like, look, maybe it's the critic in me, maybe it's the Aspie in me, maybe it's our postmodern world where we have to acknowledge that the meaning of a word is not concrete, and that absent a proper definition being made up front, anything can be a non-word with a non-meaning. So look, maybe it's more specific in the Japanese, and with a touch of cultural baggage that a layperson like myself would not get, that, you know, they've just got all the meaning just in there in the word, and you would understand it, but they don't explain what manliness is. Not knowing what it is, you can't say whether or not someone has it, which, of course, is the problem with all patriarchal societies, because no one knows what it is, no one can prove they have it, therefore it's fragile, therefore you have to be extra terrible to women. Patriarchy! And then, yeah, just also the disconnection thing, because, like, it really feels like a script in need of a rewrite, or one that was perfectly good and had a bunch of folks come in and meddle with it to the point that the final product feels off. It just, either too much work or not enough, I can't decide. And I think that's all I got.
Okay, that's fair. I think we should definitely continue. Let's go ahead and get into the womans, and I'll start us off. Fortunately, with all the things that made us, you know, groan, there were good things too, so. So, like, I'm such a sucker for seeing Elaine's holo projector thing in action. It gets me every time, so, like, I was super happy at that. I know it's dumb, but still. That moment when the Gonmisers were sounding off an alarm was really interesting. Akari getting the plasma sample was pretty boss. Like, I like that she shoots at it, that she misses, she shoots again, and then it hits, and then, like, it's crystallized, which was really neat. and like I like how Igarashi complimented her. He was just really excited about Akari in general and like how awesome she is, and that was
we can understand
to see.
That.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
I mean, he should be.
Let's see. I was happy that Igarashi was with the old crew, like, you know, Sionchi, Sage, Ryu, and himself. And, like, he lived through that, and he was hopeless at the time and really stressed out. And then they got betrayed, and everything went to crap. But, like, now he's with this new Daitenku crew, and they're going to fight to save the world from the Gamma invasion. And he is totally behind them and in support of them and, like, thrilled to entrust everything to them. And that's cool, because it really completes his character arc in a pretty subtle way, I would say. But it, like, it does it effectively. And I think what really clinches that for me is him handing the cipher book to Akari. Because that is him explicitly entrusting her and the rest of her friends with the future. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah, for me, Naruto's constant concern for Shibuya, just every step of the way, like, at least someone cares that this poor kid is, like, in distress and needs some help. Like, they kind of come as a unit and always have, and I'm just glad to see that Naruto got to, you know, be there for him as best he could. I really enjoy kind of seconding this, every scientist in this show, good or bad, has so much respect for Akari and treats her, you know, at minimum as an equal, if not, you know, infinitely better and smarter, on a scale of, like, Igor to Igarashi. And I appreciate that because she deserves it, because she's great. And then just the one scene with Cannon, you know, as they're discussing what happened, being the one to kind of be like, okay, no, I know this is hard, but y'all leave me here, I want to hear this, I need to know what happened to us and why. And I like that it was acknowledged as being hard for her, since, you know, she suffered a lot more physically than Makoto did. And, you know, I like that she didn't pass out again or something.
Yes.
Like, Cannon's a strong kid, and I'm glad they actually let her be strong for once.
Yeah, about freaking time. And like, I just want to plus one first off the Cannon bit, because I'm so glad that it's moved beyond hanging out with Alan and just repeating Oni-chan for, like, three quarters of her dialogue in any given episode. That's really nice. I'm also here for Akari basically being science boss. Like, look, there's a ton of problems in these episodes, but Akari was none of them. And for all I'm skeptical about entrusting your 8-year-old kid to clean up the mess you made, hot dang if the guy playing Ryu doesn't sell it really, really well. Like, if he's the guy in that song Black Parade who's like, son, I need you to be the savior of the broken, the beaten, and the damned, like, look, that's a lot to put on an 8-year-old kid, but, like, if that dude said it, I might consider it. He's really good. He's presence. I also like how we kind of have an explanation for why it's these 15 human heroes who are the icons, because, like, he's the one who had the book, and they're like, we need 15 spirits. I was like, well, hey, good thing I have this book here. You know, I like that. I like that we know why it's these 15 people, because they're not even, like, many of them are great. All of them are great. They're not the 15 most important people who've ever lived, because it's hard to break down a list that way. And finally, I just really also dug on Igarashi and the way they made this whole, like, thematic thing about people of different disciplines, science, spirituality, Sage, and Sionji, teaming up to save the world and also having to deal with their parents in weird ways. Like, I may not have loved the execution of this episode, but I feel like a lot of the contrasts they set up were, on a structure level, really interesting and really fun. And I think that's it for me.
I will go ahead and get us into prophecy then, starting off with what I think is going to happen. I think that Ghost Mom is definitely happening, and I don't know what I mean by that. I don't know if that means it's going to be, you know, Adele and Elaine's and Aria's mom, or if it's going to be, like, Takaru's mom specifically coming back, or if they're one and the same, possibly, or whatever. But, which, no, because they were, like, 200 years. Anyway, so somehow there's a ghosty mom coming back. And, like, it could turn out that Sage is actually, you know, Takeru's uncle and Ryu's brother-in-law, because maybe he married a ghost woman or something.
Personally, I'd be pretty down with them pulling a reverse Bleach that way. If they did it right, it might be pretty cool. I want to see Arya actually do something, though, you know, speaking of her. I mean, she's clearly got something going on in Ganma World. The, like, she's making plans to ground Adele for life, and, you know, I hope we actually get to see her do something soon. Also, where is Javert?
Yes. Yes, like, I agree.
I just want to know where he is.
Other than
out in the backyard somewhere.
If we could just get a thing with him in the background at the temple where he's just, like, reading through one of the many books about Buddhist philosophy, or, like, the life story of the Buddha. Like, you don't even have to have him do anything. It's just like, you know, we're walking by, Onari waves
like
at him,
tent
he
out
waves
in the
back.
Yard somewhere.
He's just reading. It'd be great. let's see, I think my prophecy, like, first off, y'all, did you see the bit in the next episode preview where with Akari leading the gunslinger walk? Like, she's in the center, she got the slow-mo, the slow-mo walk from like, the Wild Bunch, and like, you've got Elaine and Makoto on each side, Inari and, I think, Cannon on, you know, out on the far end, but she's in the center.
Cannon is there.
What?
You've got Shibuya and Naruto off to the side, showing up.
Yeah.
No, Cannon's there, too. I think it's Cannon and Onari on one side, and maybe Shibuya and Naruto on the other.
Thank you. But yeah, because I forgot, because I was mostly just like, Akari's in the lead. She's the leader of this crew. And I'm like, dang right she is. The Kamen Rider's out, you trust her, and I really want the next Kamen Rider movie, the crossover one that's going to happen with whoever the next person is, to just open with Enokita and Osawa just, you know, giving her an award or inviting her to, like, their sisterhood of boss Kamen Rider science ladies. I'm just saying.
I pulled up the link to the picture. It's, It is Akari, and then on either side of her is Makoto and Elaine, and on Elaine's side there's Cannon and Onari, and then it's, Shibuya and Narita going out from Makoto's, well, his right, so. Anyway. But yeah, that is a great image. So.
Yeah. Yes. They got the badass walk. I love it. I love.
She's got no time.
Yeah, exactly.
This whole show, she has had no time for anyone's shenanigans.
Yeah, no. Okay, you're gonna come invade the world? Oh, Igor, you're gonna come and talk about how science supports fascism? Let me tell you a thing. And by tell you a thing, I mean grind your face into the pavement.
Twice.
Yeah, she's just gonna slap him again. It's gonna be great. that was up there for me with, Game of Thrones. Little dude slaps a blonde kid, and it's just like, ah, yes, that was...
It's even better the second time, because the second time she does it, it's not even that she's angry, it's just a reflex upon seeing him. He just shows up and just like, oh, no, smack this guy in the face. Okay, yeah, we're moving.
So good. Finally, like, I just... Okay, two final things. I had a lot of thoughts about what's going on. First, Sionji's definitely coming back, right? We can all agree on this.
They
keep bringing him back up.
He has to.
Yeah, it needs to happen. And finally, like, I was just happy to see Cannon's actress getting to act a bit more this episode, like, do some of the face reaction, like, ooh, a pain, and the, you know, my hidden tragedy stuff that she never has to say, but she's doing. I want to see more of that. I want her to have a focus up or two that, like, is not also about, like, Alan or Makoto. Just saying, like, look, if she can help bring Takeru back from the other side and like, complete that circle, that'd be nice.
I mean, we are getting Koyomi in a couple of episodes, so I don't know, maybe they'll be tiny girlfriends.
What?
Koyomi's actress. From Wizard. Koyomi from Wizard.
Will she actually show up? Sorry.
Well, she has left that agency.
Oh, okay.
Well,
she actually, the end of that year, Wizard ended in, like, October. That January, she left. She, like, graduated the group she was in. And I can't remember where I read it, but if you can find her graduation speech, it is hilariously passive aggressive if you know the whole Wizard situation.
Hmm.
Nice.
It's all about, she's like, oh, well, I want to go become an actress, and I had, oh, this year I had all these ups and downs, and I did Kamen Rider Wizard. Like, it's.
I really want to be an actress. I'm leaving these people.
It's hilarious.
These two things are not at all related.
But, you know, just knowing that you've got, like, a girl that's been in the same role and is kind of around the same age as Cannon coming in, maybe, you know, maybe Cannon will get to do some things.
That'd be great.
Wait, how old is she?
Cannon's like 16.
Yeah, well, how old's the Koyomi lady? I mean, she...
Probably maybe like 17 or 18 now.
Really? Wow. Okay.
I don't. She was not that old.
I thought she was like 20 something. I don't know.
Wow.
I'm bad at looking at people's ages. Like, it wasn't until people pointed out that Mezul on O's was like 14. I'm like, really?
I thought she was a little older than that. I thought she was maybe 17 or 18.
Yeah, I was thinking at least like 18. But you know,
so
whatever.
At that time, I didn't realize how young they hired them. So,
yeah, I wouldn't have thought.
Let me just pull.
Oh yeah, Koyomi's
coming
back.
She was born in 1993.
Oh my gosh!
So I don't know how old that makes
An
her.
An utter baby.
Well, that's like 23.
What?
That's like 23. 1993. Yeah.
Okay, maybe and Wizard was
3 years ago now, right?
3 years ago, so she was.
Okay.
Okay,
cool.
Maybe.
All right.
Okay, she is a little older than I thought she was. So. But, yeah, no, she's coming in the next couple of weeks.
That's really cool.
I look forward to that.
So, you know, maybe that'll be.
Another apology tour? That's great.
So, we've been in this prophecy section for like 10 minutes, and we have 5 questions, so,
we should get to those.
Move right along, okay.
Okay. So question one is, were any of
no.
the revelations...
The answer is no. And the next answer is 1972. Let's go.
Okay.
Move on. No. I'm sorry. I'm done.
It's all right. Were any of the revelations made from Igarashi's past surprising, and did anything seem out of place? I'm going to start off. It all seemed to fall in line, as expected. I just don't get Sayonji's motivation, and I would have appreciated knowing how the three men in Sage all got to know each other.
You know, for me, it all lines up pretty well with everything we've received so far. I feel like we need a little more elaboration as to, you know, again, how the three of them met, how they met Sage, this, that, and the other thing. But I'm sure with time, you know, as Takeru gets more bits and pieces, he's just gonna back Sage into a corner and be like, dude, just tell me. I already know this much. Just... let's do this. Just tell me the whole thing. But the story is coming together, and it all, you know, makes sense up to this point. So, you know, good job on that.
Yeah, it's, you know, and I can't disagree, because, like, yes, it is all falling into place, and it is all falling into a place about, like, how we already thought it was gonna, which makes me wonder why they gave it so much narrative real estate here. Like, they're trying to drive home how big and important it is, but, like... we already kind of guessed this. I mean, look, again, I know that they're setting up the infinite potential daily, and like, you know, I would need you to be the savior of the broken, the beaten, and the damned, because now you have to go join the Black Parade, etc., but, like, come on, guys. You only have 20-some minutes. You gotta snap it up. You gotta do what I am just apparently physically incapable of doing, and go faster. You gotta... let's go.
Wait, are you talking about us or the show?
The show, not this show, Ghost.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, like I said, I am constitutionally incapable, so...
all right, well, does someone else want to ask the next question?
Yeah, okay.
I'm sorry for the use of Funky Tut, everybody, okay? I can't spell Tutankhamun. I don't remember it, so...
Yeah. Well, I'll just... How do you receive Tutankhamun, a.k.a. Funky, that Funky Tux, and the other icons having all these vague and convenient powers that they seem to have?
I love it. And if they are going with this whole concept of infinite potential, it works really well to never comment on how he can do all these things and just have to carry doing all sorts of random acts of goodness with his powers. The Gon Misers get to have life unending, so Takeru gets to have abilities unending.
Yeah, and I mean, like, with the fact that at the beginning of the episode, we deliberately line the heroic icons up with the Gon Misers, it doesn't feel like this weird, out-of-left-field convenient to me. Like, I'm sure Sage was like, okay, you know, the Gon Misers can do these things, so we gotta combat these things. So, you know, Tut and the others were specifically made to go against those specific powers. So, you know, of course he'd have the ability to, like, reverse time and undo that. And I think it's nice how subtly the show handled it instead of just, you know, shouting at us, we did this specific thing to go against this specific other thing. You know, just instead, you know, they show us, and it leaves us to connect the dots for ourselves. Storytelling.
Yeah, this show, like, one of my favorite things, this show knows how to tell a story, like, visually, with story, and with Stoella. Anyway, on top of everything else that you guys said, like, I also really dig that the one who would have the power to let all of these children grow up to fulfill their potential.
Oh, man.
Is Tutankhamun, this poor kid who died when he was young and never got to fulfill his potential. You know, whatever more he could have done. Which is, you know, pretty clever to me. And not to mention, I think it also gives us sort of an implication of what the Gon Misers were trying to eat, which is everyone's potential, which would explain why they have all of these people locked up in coffins in the dead world. So they're eating human potential. Like the Shida. But that's a Seven Soldiers thing, and none of y'all read enough Crazy Grant Morrison comics. Anyway, question three. Can you define what you think Takeru's perception of manliness is, and how it compares to Miho and Shibuya's?
I'm not sure that Takeru's and Miho's are all that different. You know, both of them kind of see it as doing what's right and not running away from it, but Takeru is coming from more of an emotional level, while Miho is more on a physical level. You know, Takeru comes from a place of trying to understand the people around him and take care of them, while Miho's is more, taking care of everyone by forcibly getting rid of all of the problems. And, you know, poor Shibuya is just like, I just want to exist. Like, I identify as a man and want to exist, and that is my definition of manliness.
I understand Shibuya so well.
Yeah, no.
It's like in Seinfeld, there's an episode where George and Jerry are talking about, like, oh, yeah, we could totally do this. And then George says, do you really think we could do that? And he says, well, two men could, but we couldn't. So... like, I get it. alright, so, anyway, my answer is, Miho seems to want tough, hard, strong men who are all sharp edges and firmness, and chide Shibuya even at the end for being mushy. Shibuya seems to be saying that he is a man even though he is mushy, and Takeru seems to think that doing cool stuff makes one a man, sort of. I think I am most in agreement with Shibuya about what a man is, out of those three. But there's definitely room for improvement in the perception of manliness in Japan and across the globe. Also, speaking of Japan and manliness, and the cool thing idea that tickled Takeru, it reminded me of in Fully Cooley. There's, I think it's like the fourth episode, or how many? It's a 6-episode show, right?
Yeah, I think so.
6 or 8.
Okay.
I can't remember which.
Well, there's the episode that with the airsoft, and I think in the preview they're talking about like how people who do, they're making fun of like John Woo films and stuff too, and they're saying that like idiots do cool things because they're idiots, like, and that's why it comes off as so cool. Anyway, it just made me think of like, yeah, a man is cool and a man does stupid things, because like fighting 6 ghost people with a stick is, like, pretty stupid, when you have no powers.
Gainax kind of brings that idea back in Gurren Lagann, and kind of explores it a lot. Mostly in the first 8 episodes, but even after that.
That's cool.
Like, they kind of explore that specific idea in the first 8 episodes and, like, the repercussions of it. In, like, maybe the 4 or 5 that follow that. And, like, there's a lot of actually, like, questioning manliness in Gurren Lagann.
See, now I'm curious about it, because, like, I only ever saw the movie, and, like, the movie is just a really short-form version, and it just
yeah.
does not
I mean, the movies well. Are, the movies are really good, but definitely, like, watch the whole show. Because there's a lot more, you know, room to play.
And like, just for my answer real quick, all I know is that this Shibuya kid, he's honest about his emotions, and is continues to be honest about them in the face of physical and emotional violence by someone he loves and whom he cannot or will not fight back against. Like, if that's not a thing that deserves respect, I do not know what is. Like, I don't like to, you know, bring in gender essentialist stuff, because I need to just, on a personal level, get beyond that. But, yo, that is baller as hell, dude. Like, just a torrent of abuse, and you just stand there and take it? Like, hard as heck. The next question, question 4. Did Miho's turn at the end make sense to you?
Only in the way that I know how writing this story works. So, of course, you know, at the end she turns and half, but not fully, acknowledges Shibuya's quote-unquote manliness. And now everyone is happy. And she says, you know, oh, well, now you're starting to look manly. And, you know, now we're going to hug and everything's fine. And I still think it's lazy and irresponsible. But that's the meta-text. But from the context, like, the standpoint of context, not really. Like, does she remember what happened when she turned into a kid? Because it doesn't make sense for her to, and she doesn't seem to. So why is she suddenly like, oh, but now I kind of see your manliness and is, like, okay with him? Like, what the heck happened? Last she knew, she was screaming at him on the phone. And now they're hugging and everything's okay. Again, lazy and irresponsible, but it doesn't really make sense.
Right. Sonny, you nailed it. I don't really know that I can add anything, so I'm not going to try.
Yeah, no, you hit the big notes there, because it was just, like you said, lazy. Lazy and irresponsible. I hate things that are those things. I hate them so much.
It's true. I also do.
And our final question. Who was the lady who said thank you to Takeru at the end?
I mean, my gut instinct jumped to Takeru's mom, but maybe that's because I'm just desperate for her existence to be acknowledged. I mean, I'd love if it was her, but I'm willing to take pretty much anything that brings another cool lady into the story. Or, you know, maybe it's just Arya being like, hi, thanks, I'm sorry my brother's a jerk. Because I'm not good at recognizing voices, and she hasn't said anything in, like, 400 years. So, I don't know if it was her or someone else, Takeru's mom, maybe Elaine's mom. I don't know. But, you know, gut instinct, Takeru's mom. Hmm. Why? I don't know. I don't know why any random ghost woman would be thanking him at the moment. Except for maybe Himiko.
Yeah, she didn't look old enough to be Himiko.
Yeah.
Hmm. I think this poorly crafted story feels like an opening to bring Takeru's mom into the show, which kind of makes what we just saw worse, but also makes me hope and wish that this arc was done to connect Takeru to his hitherto unmentioned mother and help the audience to connect to her as a cool character, because nobody likes moms or something. Like, is that what they think? Like, yeah, we gotta do this whole thing to set up his mom coming in. So, I don't know.
If that's what they think, they have clearly never met me.
Well, and I just, like, I don't understand why that would be a thing, because, well, I mean, you know, if we're gonna get back to the manliness problem we were discussing, because there is a certain school of manliness in like, history where men have thought, like, oh, no, like, the baby, that's all me. Yeah, but came from out of her. Yeah, but she doesn't contribute anything. She's just the incubator. It's all me, that baby. That's all me. It's like maybe there's some people at Toei with that kind of biz going on. I don't know. It's messed up. But I'm glad that there's a possibility we could have some moms in Kamen Rider for the first time since...
Double.
It's been a while. It's really been a while.
Double, what's maybe that? O's.
Yeah.
If you think, if we're counting Mizzou.
Yeah, like, it's been a bit. There have not been many, which is weird since, like, some have had moms mentioned in passing. And, okay, Amazons. There's one in Amazons, and she's amazing. Yeah, it's not often. And
does she get amazing? Because last I was watching, I kind of wanted to smack her.
Yeah, but she's an amazing character. She's not a
okay. Yes,
character.
No, she's a great character. She's just
she's
a terrible
a great character,
person.
Very well acted.
She's a great character, and she's in a position of power, and I love all of that. But she's a terrible person.
Oh yeah, she's an awful. She is though. Well, she's probably like the second or third worst. There's a lot of really awful people in Amazons, but it's a great show.
Yeah, there is.
But yeah, like, I would really like to get to know Takaru's mom, because it's been a while since a Kamen Rider had a mom, which is, again...
That was alive.
Weird. Because, like, look, Yeah, I'm done. But I think we had one more... you had an extra thing you wanted to drop, Sono, before we headed out?
In the context of us answering this last question, I was thinking, about moms in Kamen Rider. And Hasegawa has written a lot of the recent parental kind of arcs in Kamen Rider. And I'm just kind of curious as to if he has some kind of uncomfortable relationship maybe with his mom or both of his parents. Because, I mean, if you look at specifically his track record over the past handful of years... Like, he wrote the bulk of the Shroud stuff in Double. We looked it up, and he wrote that, puppet doll episode. He wrote a lot of the stuff with Go and Bano, which involved their, Go and Kiriko's deceased mother and how she wanted nothing to do with him at one point, and their, you know, divorced parents with a bad relationship. I know he did Jake's big arc, which was about, you know, Jake and his dad's strained relationship. I'm very curious as to how his family life, has informed his writing, since this is a really consistent pattern over the past, you know, handful of years in, you know, post-Decade Kamen Rider.
Yeah, which, like, and it's that thing where, we at Uncommon Cast RX are not saying that he has. We're not diagnosing. We are questioning
because this is a well he keeps
going back to. We don't know. We don't want to know. We are not asserting.
Yeah, I mean, it's none of my business.
I know you're not saying that, so no, I just wanted extra explicit
clearing this all up for everyone.
Because we don't want... We are just souls whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let us be misunderstood.
It's very curious because he also has a very odd track record with either doing it very well or very poorly.
Yeah. Like I think you were saying that he wrote most of the best stuff about the Sonozakis in Double?
Yes, I know. I would need to go back and look at the exact, you know, breakdown, but I know that he wrote the episode in the mid-30s where we actually get all of the background on from Shroud to Terui Ryu about what happened to them. And,
that was,
you know,
intense stuff.
And it was a really good couple of episodes.
Best part of that show.
And, you know, kind of Shroud taking responsibility for everything. Even taking responsibility for what happened to Terui Ryu's family. And, but then, you know, he also wrote the Go and Bano stuff. Which was not good.
Which is, like, inexplicably bad, almost.
Yeah, that was, like, it was awful. Like, amazingly awful.
But,
like,
you know, then...
try to be bad.
But then again, like, again, he wrote the Capricorn arc, and a lot of the stuff with Jake and, you know, him coming to terms with his relationship with his dad and how he can't, you know, be what he thought he could have because of his dad. Like, that was also all really good. And that was, you know, a self-contained arc, but this is a self-contained arc, and it was not good. So, he's very consistently writing about kind of messed up, broken families, except it's not, it's either consistently really good or really bad. And I'm very curious as to, you know, how all of this happened and what in his life is informing the things that he's writing.
Now, Hasegawa-san, if you'd like to come on with us and, you know, talk to us, we'd love to.
And open up about your deepest, darkest secrets to three strangers from another continent.
Another two continents. You know, yeah, we'd like to console you, because we enjoy your stuff, but, you know, we're just confused.
We'd love to just hear your...
is that going too far?
That
funny, but I have a really gross sense of humor, so you should run that by someone who is not terrible like me.
But, I mean, like, I don't know if there's maybe interviews out there somewhere that someone knows about, you know,
but it's,
just
it's,
things
it's,
people knows that if they, you know, want to pass that our way.
Yeah, that'd be really interesting.
He's really,
it's just,
he's
you know,
really
very
good
interesting.
At it. Or again, like, really awful, but like, when he's good, when that guy is on, he is on, and in a way that is so good you kind of forget, oh yeah, someone had to craft this, I am not just watching a documentary, which is a stupid thing to say because, you know, Kamen Rider, but
yeah.
Sometimes media can be good enough that you forget that it's a creation. And
yeah, that you're not just watching actual people.
Yeah, which, like, again, y'all know I'm not a double guy. The Sonozakis were like the bits where I was like, okay, I want more. And then we kept
and again, like, I went on a whole Twitter ramble about the Sonozakis and, you know, kind of how responsibly double handled Shroud in the end. Just with how much responsibility she takes for everything and the fact that she's, Philip, like, goes to her and is like, but we can be a family again. And she's like, no, I don't deserve that.
Have you met me?
I know what
I'm
I
not
did.
A family person.
Your family, it's like, your family is these people now, not us. We have not done good things to you. You are happy over there. Go over there.
I love you too, kid. Don't ever come near me. I am human poison. But what about the rest of the family? They are toxic waste that me and my husband kind of made. Sorry! Turns out that dying was the best thing that could have happened to you, kid. Later!
And just, you know, like, the last scene of her and Wakana, when she tells Wakana how to do the Gaia Impact, like, again, that's very much her kind of taking responsibility for walking out on her kids. Where she's like, you know what? You can make your own decisions. I'm gonna tell you this thing you wanna know. You can do this. I don't deserve. I'm just gonna go fall over and die now because this is all about you kids now. We've had our time. You can do this, and I trust you.
Yeah. But, I think we'd probably best be going, otherwise we're going to find another tangent to go off on, and then we will never leave, and Amit will never get to go home to his wife and kids, and that would be a tragedy. Right? That would be no, I'm kidding. That's me doing more bad parent humor. I should stop. It's actually not funny at all. I know that. I'm sorry.
Sorry, I was trying to chime in that I would have to just stay here for the sake of the show. You know, because that's what's important.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the show must go on.
This is true.
And,
that's what they say.
And it does go on and on. And that's why, for Uncommon Cast RX, I'm Aleph.
And I am Amit.
And I'm Sona.
And we'll see you next time. Run before we start talking again.
Okay, bye.